Our next case is Dynex Softcon GmbH v. Agilent Technologies, Inc., 21-1794. Counsel for the appellant, Mr. Bisbister. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank
okay.
You.
Let me touch on a couple of administrative issues. Have we sorted out who's going to be arguing? Is that already, that's issue taken care of?
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand you're going to argue for the appellant in both of the cases, in the next one as well, and Mr. Saganga is going to argue on behalf of the appellee in both cases. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And I ask because we were getting motions and, as you know, communications at the late hour yesterday, but I'm glad to hear that we got everything squared away as to who's going to be arguing. The cases are not consolidated. We're going to take one right after the other, but I am going to ask that we not repeat arguments to the fullest extent possible. I'll leave that up to you, but, you know, once we move from one argument to the next, I think that we'd have heard enough to help us do our job, okay?
So, Your Honor, does that mean that I should limit my initial comments to simply the 1794 case and then...
Yeah, limit your comments to the 1794 case to the fullest extent possible. And you got 6 minutes reserved for your rebuttal time. It's just given, perhaps we should have consolidated the cases for argument. I think it would have proceeded a little bit smoothly. Just in the interest of time, I don't want to hear repeat arguments in the next case. Okay, so you may proceed.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. James Bisbister on behalf of Appellant Dynex, and with me at council table are my colleague Christopher Reed and in-house counsel for Dynex, Rip Binst. Affirming the board's finding on priority in the 1794 case, or frankly in the second case that we will address, the 2372 case, would dramatically alter the corroboration requirement. The count recites an arrangement of hydraulic components that are used to perform a particular method. The board stated that the key corroborating witness need not remember the hydraulic configuration to provide corroboration. And indeed, that witness never even knew the hydraulic configuration, nor did that witness know what method had been used, had no personal knowledge of that. Up to now, this court has required corroborating evidence of the subject matter of the count and has insisted that the evidence of corroboration that relied directly or indirectly on the inventor, him or herself, is legally insufficient. The evidence that Agilent presented and that the board endorsed fails to meet that standard. The primary dispute with respect to priority arises from one aspect of Agilent's purported 2007 reduction to practice. Did Agilent reduce to practice a system that allowed for pre-compression of the sample loop in this instrument all the way up to the pressure existing on the other side of the injection valve where the column existed? Or did Agilent simply contemplate partial pre-compression combined with other techniques such as make before break that would alleviate the pressure shock problem that the inventors were addressing? This is not a trivial distinction. As Mr. Nugent testified, Dynex's expert, as of 2007, there was no metering device, no sample uptake device that was able to create or withstand the high pressures on the column side of the instrument.
We have a couple witnesses that are not Mr. Kratz that testified that Mr. Kratz and Mr. Glatz modified a pump so that to be that metering device. So the evidence is that, according to these witnesses, they didn't just take a conventional metering device that was available at the time. They custom made a metering device that could handle high pressures. And that's why the schematics refer to a high pressure metering device.
That is correct, Your Honor. But the schematics do not refer to a metering device that is able to reach the same pressure as the column side, and Mr. Kretz and the other witnesses admitted for Agilent that pre-compression could mean partial pre-compression, which would require some ability to increase the pressure from ambient to some higher pressure. We just specifically discussed 200 or 400 atmospheres, pressures that would be far beyond normal and certainly would be high. So although there is reference in the schematic, and I assume here you're referring to Exhibit 2152, the schematic from November of 2008 that show a high-pressure metering device, first of all, as a temporal matter, that schematic is irrelevant. We know that that schematic was created in a CAD program on November 6th.
It's not per se irrelevant. Wasn't it for the fact finder to make a determination as to whether, under the totality of the evidence, what did that document, that schematic, look like at the more relevant time, at the date of priority? And that's a finding they made, and it comes to us on review of a finding from a fact finder. Isn't that correct?
I agree.
Because I think I should just make sure I'm not reading the wrong document. The document was undisputedly created prior to the 2017 date, right? It just was not. It was last edited after that date.
Yes, but I think there's an important distinction here. The document was created earlier. It was last saved in, I think, the third week of November 2008. It incorporates a CAD drawing that is unambiguously, undisputedly created on November 6, 2008. So that document didn't exist before November 6, 2008. There may have been a document similar to that, but we don't have that document. And this is why I think this case is so unusual. The only way we know that the prototype that was purportedly created in 2007 tracked the design that was shown in the document dated 2008 is Mr. Kretz's testimony. The other primary witness, Mr. Bowerly, conceded that A, was never revealed to him what the hydraulic configuration of the instrument was, the prototype was. B, he never looked at the specially milled valve that was required in order to effectuate the design shown in 2152.
Mr. Bowerly did testify that what he did see was a version of Exhibit 2152. And he does remember there being a modified pump that served as a high-pressure metering device. He did see the entire prototype and see it in operation, and then ultimately see over the shoulder of Mr. Kretz a computer screen showing the results of operation of the prototype with minimal pressure spikes, and thereby signaling that, in fact, there was success in achieving some form of pressure equalization. So, this was all specific testimony that Mr. Bowerly testified to, and as I understand it, the board credited. So Mr. Bowerly's testimony, Mr. Burns' testimony, these exhibits, I mean, when you look at it all together, the board reached a fact-finding under the rule of reason that there was adequate corroboration here. So I'm having a hard time trying to figure out how I would conclude that this was just unreasonable or, as a matter of law, what is in the record could not possibly satisfy the corroboration requirement.
Your Honor, with all respect, I think you're conflating two questions. Did Mr. Bowerly see Exhibit 2152 or a version of 2152 that looks similar to it?
A version of 2152, yeah.
And did Mr. Bowerly see a metering device modified as Mr. Kress testified he modified it? Or an injection valve modified as Mr. Kress suggested he did? And Mr. Bowerly was absolutely clear. He did not see either of those devices. He did not look at them. To him, the prototype sitting on the other side of that door, 10 yards away from his office, was a black box. He understood what was in the black box because Mr. Kretz told him, it's something I built to the design shown in this earlier version of 2152. And so the only way we know the prototype...
Mr. Rowley and Mr. Berndt, didn't they both testify that Mr. Kretz and Mr. Glatz modified a pump so that it would serve as a high-pressure metering device?
They both testified that there was modification, that they were aware of modification of a pump because Mr. Kretz told them he had done so. So it's almost a...
During the relevant time frame, they didn't hear that after the fact from Mr. Kretz. They heard that during the 2005-2007 time frame.
And in particular, of course, one of the modifications, not to the pump, but rather to the valve, that's what Mr. Bowerly specifically addressed, he was aware that the valve was specially milled to create elongated grooves. Now, elongated grooves, as we pointed out, are the way you effectuate make before break. And so that information doesn't confirm that the pre-compression was happening to the full pre-compression level. It merely confirms that there was work being done to address the pressure shock of some nature, possibly make before break.
But what about Mr. Barley's testimony that he saw the test results?
And thank you for bringing that up, Your Honor.
He remarked about how Mr. Kratz was very excited about those test results.
Thank you for raising that, because the test results that Mr. Bowerly saw, he concedes, are the pressure readings from the column side. Now, nothing in the count is directed to the pressure on the column side. The count requires the elevation of the pressure in the sample loop. Now, if Mr. Bowerly saw a pressure plot that showed 1 atmosphere at the outset, ambient, rising to 600 bar at the completion, that would have been confirmation of actually performing the method of the count. But that's not what Mr. Bowerly saw. What Mr. Bowerly saw was the steady pressure on the column side without any indication as to how that steady pressure was created. Was it created by using a metering device that increased the pressure all the way to the full pressure? Or was it created by some combination of partial pre-compression with the metering device on the sample loop combined with make before break, which is what the documentary record would seem to reflect? I see I've gone past the time I had reserved for the opening. I will reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Skanga, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes, Your Honor, Skanga.
All right.
Thank you, and good morning, Your Honors. The board reached the correct decision in awarding priority to Agilent. It properly considered that Agilent had the burden only by a preponderance. There was a substantial evidence supporting the conclusion, and thus this court should affirm. The evidence allows a reasonable conclusion to be drawn, and that satisfies the substantial evidence standard. And I think Dianex's arguments seem to want to elevate that standard to say, well, there can't be, the proof has to be absolutely unrebuttable. There can't be any countervailing evidence. And that's not the standard. It's a rule of reason standard on corroboration. The issue is ultimately the credibility of the inventor. And we're not asking for a new corroboration standard. The inventor always has to be part of the corroboration analysis.
What is the evidence you have of corroboration that is completely independent of the inventor here?
Well, we do have the documents themselves.
But what the board saw in the documents seems to be ultimately traceable back to what the inventor said one would see in the documents. Isn't that right?
Well, but in addition, we have the metadata showing when the documents were worked on. That's generated by the computer. That's not something from the inventor. We have the non-inventors observing in the machine shop the prototype running. We have the the test results, which a non-inventor Bowerly saw. And I think this case is analogous to Cooper v. Goldfarb, you know, where the Gore-Tex invention was at issue. And the inventor Goldfarb was the one who observed the disputed claim limitation. It was a microscopic measurement of a fibril within the material. And he was the one, eyes on the microscope, and the inventor was the one who told the non-inventor witnesses, here's what I found. And the court found that that was sufficient to be corroboration. So to totally divorce ourselves from the inventor when it is the inventor's work that and the timing of it that needs to be corroborated, you know, gets us perhaps to this, you know, impossible standard, which we know from the case law is not what should be applied. So applying the rule of reason, we have indicia of credibility of the inventor. He's created contemporaneous documents. We have non-inventors observing his work, remembering specific details about critical components like converting the high-pressure pump into the high-pressure metering device. We have the subsequent innovation disclosure form, which corroborates the time frames here. And the fact that we have multiple non-inventors recalling these events is also part of the totality of circumstances that the board properly considered.
The other side this morning said that the test results that Mr. Bowerly witnessed don't actually reflect that he didn't testify to seeing pressure equalization between the sample group and the column.
Well, what the pressure plots represented was whether there were the unwanted spikes in the pressure. That was the goal of the invention, was to avoid spikes which could be damaging to the equipment or, you know, flush fluids into the wrong place at the wrong time. And the plot demonstrated the success of the test in achieving that elimination of the pressure spikes.
What's the plot actually showing?
The plot is showing the pressure on the operating side of the system.
On the column side.
It is the column side pressure, but the witness's recall is that was a very meaningful result, right? A meaningful step forward. It was memorable. It was something that the inventor was proud of. That demonstrated the proof of concept, because if the pre-compression didn't work, we wouldn't have seen such a nice, flat, even plot. That's how it ties back to the pre-compression. It's because the results were good, the inventor and the non-inventors are able to recall, yes, I got these very memorable, favorable results, and I recall the way I got them was by doing the pre-compression, which...
The only way, is it true or not true that the only way to get those good results is through pressure equalization? Or perhaps is there another way to get there?
We believe it is the only way. The only testimony that was drawn out on cross-exam was, theoretically, would it be possible to only partially pre-compress? And if you did that, would you expect that there might be some improvement in the pressure spikes? And the witnesses said, well, could be. That's a possibility.
I'm hearing this morning that there's a possible other way, which would be partial pre-compression in addition to something called make or break.
Right, and I think that's simply a theory by Dynex, which wasn't backed up by the evidence. We have the contemporaneous documents referring to the high-pressure metering device and the HP valve, the high-pressure valve, on the same schematic, and the recollection of having to match those because of the environment being more difficult at a high pressure. What we don't have is anything referring to a partial pressure. There's no medium pressure metering devices anywhere in the record. There's no partial precompression referred to anywhere other than as a theory advanced by Dynex. And what I think is important here is that, you know, when presented essentially with this theory of, well, could you have done it a little differently? You know, is there some other way that you might have gotten some of this benefit? None of the witnesses recanted. None of the witnesses said, oh, now that you mentioned that possibility that we could have done this another way besides fully pre-compressing as in the count. None of them said, oh, you know, that refreshes my memory. Yeah, that was what we were doing in that prototype. And there wasn't even the follow-up kinds of questions like that. To say, gee, isn't it possible that that system you remember was doing this this alternate approach? That's why I think that there's substantial evidence is that what we have is a theory that wasn't fully borne out in cross-examination versus a very robust record showing that there are many different.
Was that theory presented to the board? I'm trying to remember if the board decision.
Absolutely. It was presented to the board, and that's why the board, there was a lot of focus on the word pre-compression. You know, in those contemporaneous schematics, there was a heading, pre-compression.
I understand there was a theory that it was only partial compression. It wasn't the full equalization compression, pressurization, but nevertheless, I'm talking about more the idea of perhaps what got Mr. Kratz the good test results was some combination of partial pressurization with something else, some other contraption that could together get you the nice plot lines.
Well, again, there was no testimony, no evidence that there was an alternate prototype that got good results that used some mix and match of other technologies. And the reason why I refer to the pre-compression word is because the board looked at that and said, well, okay, by itself, that word doesn't necessarily answer the question of was it full pressure equilibration? And the board analyzed the record further and concluded that as a totality, there was support. But I think Your Honor may be referring to the make before break approach that Dynex counsel just mentioned. And that was an approach that was a precursor, and it was different because there was no active pressure change in the make before break approach. The goal of make before break was simply to change the timing of when the high pressure side and the sample side were in communication with each other and how quickly the transitions were from one to the other. So that was done by modifying that rotary valve device and by modifying grooves in the valve. So, but it was a different approach where there was no active increase in the pressure on the sample side. And again, I'd say it's theory by Dynex, but there was no actual record evidence that anyone mixed those two together. Rather, the evidence was the pieces were in place to get to the invention as claimed in the count. One of those pieces was modifying the rotary valve, changing the shape of the grooves there. Another piece was getting that high pressure pump modified to work as a high pressure metering device. And so that's how it was relevant in our view and why that was addressed.
I just want to make sure, sorry, to be clear, the argument we heard this morning, was it argued to the board, this combination of MBB and the partial compression?
I thought that they were somewhat distinct below. I thought that it was either, hey, you were just working on MBB or you were working on a partial pre-compression. I don't think this
the argument that they were put together and that could have explained the smooth results. You're not sure if that was actually
well. And again, I believe the record shows the witnesses believed the good test results were the indication of the full pressurization and the count, not of any other possible theory. I do want to mention the hydraulic configuration issue. This is another example of a theory that never got fleshed out. Bowerly said, well, I didn't see the full hydraulic configuration, and he didn't need to. He didn't need to look under the hood to see every hose and pipe on the prototype. And he was never asked, oh, this element of the count, isn't that one of those hydraulic configuration things you didn't know about? He wasn't asked that because the count doesn't talk about the invention at that level of detail. So Mr. Bowerly was consistent in that he understood the arrangement. He had seen versions of the schematic in Exhibit 2152. And he understood that was what the prototype utilized and that the results were positive and a result of having achieved the count. I want to talk briefly about the depressurizing step. This is what has been referred to as step 3B1 in the count, because Dynex has to win on both of these points. They have to show that we failed to establish priority, both with respect to 3B2, which is the increasing the pressure on the sample side up to the operating pressure. And they also have to show that we failed to make our case on the depressurizing step, this 3B1. And the claim is worded as requiring, in the alternative, it's one of the following two steps. Depressurizing, which is bringing the system from operating pressure back down to ambient, which you need to do to cycle through to pick up your next sample. Or, and I'm quoting from the claim, quote, one of, we go to the depressurizing step, and then quote, or the pre-compression step. And Dynex has really skipped over this, and even with all of these arguments about what might have happened on the pre-compression side, they haven't undercut any of the very robust evidence of record that we did meet that alternative depressurizing step with the prototype that was built and did so in the
board didn't reach that issue though, right?
I'm sorry?
The board did not reach that issue.
Your Honor, no, it was addressed in the judgment, and what the board did was it basically said, Agilent, we're going to hold you to your proofs on this. We argued below that Dynex had essentially conceded the point, therefore we win. And the board said, well, we're going to do more than just simply say, it's been waived by Dynex and therefore you win. The board went ahead and said, regardless of that, we do.
So the board didn't actually make a finding on that point.
I would characterize it as the other way around. The board said, we're not going to rule that Dynex waived its opposition to this issue, but upon reviewing the record, we find that you win, Agilent, regardless of what Dynex did. Agilent, you've.
But that's on the pressure equalization step. The board didn't say you win also because of the decompression step.
No, I do believe that it is specifically, there's a section in the judgment specifically talking about that. And let me see if I can give Your Honor a specific quote on that. That is in the first appendix, the judgment at it's at 72-73, the appendix 72, pages 72-73, and the appendix in this first appeal that we're addressing here. And basically say whether contested or not, Agilent, you've met your burden here, and so that we think is something that was addressed properly here. I'll read from the top of page 28 here. It's appendix 73. To the extent the B1 option is uncontested, our determination that Agilent has proven its alleged reduction to practice of count 2 would be unchanged. So
that would be unchanged because it found a reduction of practice for the B2 option.
Well, in the preceding paragraph, it's explaining our argument that we we satisfied the B1 option as well.
Okay, we can figure out how to do it. That's fine.
So,
can you conclude, please?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think the other issue that wasn't mentioned that I want to just touch on is that Dionex felt that the record was so overwhelming against them that they resorted to asking for a negative inference to be drawn against us, and there was just no support for overturning the board's decision on that discretionary decision. There was no spoliation, no untoward acts, and I think indicative of the fact that the record was quite robust as is.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 4 minutes left in the rebuttal time.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin with that last point, the negative inference. Please bear in mind that this is an interference. There's a small amount of automatic discovery provided by Section 150 of the Standing Order Governing Interferences. Other than that, there's almost no way to get discovery in an interference. Agilent cherry-picked the evidence it wanted to present. This was the evidence that best supported its case. The evidence, for example, of continuing efforts on make before break, Agilent didn't need to share that with us. We don't know what that evidence was like. Speaking of make before break, I'd like to direct the court to a section in the deposition of Mr. Bowerly. Now, in the 2372 case, it's at Appendix 3613. I will try to dig up the corresponding appendix number in the 1794 case, but the evidence is identical. Question: and in a make before break approach, the pressure in the sample loop is brought up to or approaching the system pressure before the sample loop was connected to the fluid path between the pump and the column, right? Answer, correct. So, to your earlier questions, Judge Chen, make before break is absolutely an alternative to full precompression if the goal is to bring the sample loop up to that maximum pressure before connecting up to the path. Turns out, at least as reflected by the testing that was done in October of 2008, that it didn't work very well. There was also statements from Mr. Skanka that I believe may have overlooked a part of the record. 2152, that exhibit, is that about make before break in addition to some form of precompression? And I think the answer to that is definitely yes. If you look at page 145 of the Kretz deposition that appears at Appendix 3437 in the 2372 appeal, and continuing on to the top of page 146, the question is asked, so 2152 combines a number of ideas, including make before break. Answer, uh-huh. The particular idea in 2152 is the elongated groove that comes straight out of make before break. So we know that 2152 is a combination of both make before break and compression. What we don't know from any source other than Mr. Kretz is that the pressure that was achieved with that pre-compression was in fact equal to the pressure of the pump. And as a result, there is no corroboration of a reduction to practice of the count from any source other than Mr. Kretz, the inventor himself. As a result, affirming the board's finding that there was a corroborated reduction to practice would substantially change 150 years of legal jurisprudence regarding the corroboration requirement. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.